Luke 12, The Leaven of the Pharisees. The third talk about Jesus' teaching on Phariseeism was presented by Larry Barber on April 27, 2003, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This morning I want to look at a passage in Luke's Gospel, chapter 12. This is a passage that some of you around here have probably heard taught before, maybe even heard me teach before some time ago. I heard this passage actually taught for the first time probably 26, 7 years ago by Jack down at Peninsula Bible Church, and it was really helpful to me in terms of understanding the gospel and understanding myself, and it's something that I think is helpful to kind of remind ourselves of from time to time because it's so true and helpful. So I hope it's helpful to you. And I wanted to sort of apologize ahead of time, too, because I had planned on having an embedded reporter here this morning. And just time commitments and trying to find a Pharisee who was going to be willing to be open about their struggles in life, it just took much time and they couldn't do it. So I planned on that happening, but it just didn't work. So speaking of books, one of my favorite all-time books is C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce. And I think Lewis in that book really understands something very profound about himself and about the human condition. He understands the reality that he was a broken, morally broken, bankrupt person. He also understood the difficulty that we have as morally broken human beings in coming to terms with that reality. He understood the central importance of coming to this understanding has for eternal life, and the mercy that is given to those who come to this crucial realization. I think he communicates this pretty amazingly in this book, again, The Great Divorce. In one of the stories that he tells, it's basically a series of encounters that people who have taken this bus ride from hell to heaven, it's these encounters they have with these people in heaven. And in one of these encounters, he writes about a ghost woman who's taken this bus ride from hell to heaven. And the purpose of her visit and her journey is to visit her son. She really wants to see her son. She's pretty desperate about it. And upon arriving, she encounters a bright spirit. And this bright spirit had actually been her brother on earth. And through the course of their interaction, the bright spirit attempts to explain to his sister the requirements for seeing her son and for making her visit in heaven a permanent one. This bright spirit, her brother, tries to communicate to her that her ghostly appearance, her ghostly body, must be transformed into a spirit of substance. And in order for that to happen, the woman must concede the reality that her natural motivations while on earth were self-serving and hurtful to other people. She must be honest with herself about what is true about herself. And if she can, then she can stay, and she can see her son. Her brother explains to her, and this is a quote, "No natural feelings are high or low, holy or unholy in themselves. They are all holy when God's hand is on the rein. They all go bad when they set up on their own and make themselves into false gods." If his sister can come to understand and can come to terms with this crucial understanding, if she fails to come to terms with this crucial understanding and fails to be transformed into a spirit of substance, she cannot become a citizen of heaven, she cannot see her son, and she has to go back to hell. Despite all these incentives, she has great difficulty accepting the responsibility that her motivations while on earth could have been anything but good or pure. Now, I mean, think about this for a second. Here's this lady. She has just taken a bus ride from hell, okay? She was in hell for who knows how long, okay? She's been there. She takes this bus ride to heaven. Her brother's there, her son's there, and she's being very self-righteous. She doesn't get it. She doesn't see it. She is very much like the lawyer and the Pharisees that we have been looking at the last couple of weeks. Each of them have this compulsive need, this sort of characterological, neurotic need, to see themselves as being right and cannot accept the possibility that they could be wrong. And that's kind of what we've been seeing in this as we looked at the passages the couple of weeks in terms of how they interacted with Jesus and just how they approached life, the scriptures, and again, Jesus. There are a whole lot of factors that play a part in determining our motivations, good, bad, conscious, unconscious. The Bible is very much concerned about our hearts and the values we have, the beliefs we have that motivate our behavior. In Luke chapter 12, the passage that we'll be looking at here this morning, Jesus takes the opportunity to address this issue with his disciples. And in considering this passage, I want to unpack, I think, what is underneath this defensiveness on the part of the woman, this need for her to see herself as be right, and also the self-justifying behavior of these men that Jesus has been interacting with. So let's look at Luke 12, starting with verse 1. Under these circumstances, after so many thousands of the multitude had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, Jesus began saying to his disciples, "First of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." Just prior to this event, in chapter 11, Luke records that Jesus had just got through confronting the scribes and the Pharisees for their hypocrisy. And he cites several very glaring examples. And they respond by becoming, Luke says, very hostile towards Jesus and questioning him on many subjects. So again, Jesus has confronted them on their hypocrisy. It's very glaring. If you read chapter 11, you'll see it's very easy to see the hypocrisy as Jesus describes it and points it out. They respond to him by becoming very hostile towards him, and they sort of question him a lot. The circumstances of Luke 12, Jesus observes this hypocrisy being played out in the crowd, and he draws it to the attention of the disciples. Now, it seems to me that in chapter 11, it's very glaring what Jesus points out. In chapter 12, it's not so glaring, and I think perhaps this is why Jesus is drawing it to the attention of the disciples. Plus, I also think what he sees happening in the crowd is a little more subtle than what he's described in chapter 11. So I think it's important to him, and he says, "This is really important, guys. I want you to look at that, see it." And he brings it to their attention. The situation that Jesus observed was that so many thousands of the multitudes had gathered together that they were literally stepping on one another. They were apparently trying to get closer to Jesus, so much so that they were literally stepping on each other. What is most helpful, I think, and unique about this passage is that not only does Luke describe what was happening, what the historical context, but he also records Jesus' comments about what was happening. And Jesus' warning to his disciples comes in direct response to what he observed happening in the crowd. So Luke's account provides you and I with a great vantage point to understand what is going on in the crowd, and then also to understand Jesus' perspective on it and what's really going on. So rather having a simple historical narrative, Jesus interacting with somebody or his disciples, we have this opportunity to understand this particular moment in history from through the eyes of Jesus. Jesus observed a dynamic operating in these people that were gathering around him. As they pressed against each other, as they stepped on one another, in order to apparently get close to Jesus, they were making something known about themselves. Jesus observes this, and he turns to his disciples, and he says, "Look, guys, this is really important. First of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." In our culture, we think about hypocrisy as not practicing what you preach, sort of pretentiousness, insincerity. It's the pretense or insincerity involved in telling other people how they ought to live while living inconsistently with the beliefs that we assert to be valuable and true of ourselves. That's how we think of hypocrisy in this culture. However, as you look at the New Testament, it's clear that the Pharisees were not characterized by insincerity or pretentiousness. They were a religious organization, a group of men dedicated, who kind of banded together, kind of like in a fraternity or a Bible study, in small independent groups led by oftentimes a scribe or a lawyer. And they did this for the purpose of educating themselves and encouraging one another in the observance of the Mosaic Law. Josephus, who is a respected first century historian, describes the Pharisees as, quote, having the reputation for excelling the rest of the nation in the observance of religion. He goes on to say that it was the accurate interpretation of the Mosaic Law and scrupulous adherence to it that characterized the religiosity of the average Pharisee. This is a fairly glowing description of the Pharisees. It's very different than Jesus's, very qualitatively different. I don't know if I think I remember this, but I think that Josephus at one time was a Pharisee himself, wasn't he? So that makes sense. So the Pharisees were not hypocritical people in the way that we understand hypocrisy in our culture. They were very sincere, very genuine men who apparently took their relationship with God very seriously. So what is Jesus getting at here? What's going on? What does he mean? Historically, the word hypocrisy has its origins in the Greek theater. The term was used to describe an actor, a person who performed a role or portrayed a character, who acted out a script in a play. A good actor, if he hoped to portray his part accurately and persuasively, would try to take on his character's persona as much as possible. He would put great effort into knowing and understanding the character that he was portraying, what his character felt, what he thought, how he looked at things, what he wanted, what was important to him. While on stage, an actor would, as much as humanly possible, try to be as much like the character that he was portraying as much as he possibly could. The goal of an actor's performance was to win the approval and applause of his audience. This desire for approval is what motivated actors to work long and hard hours at getting their character just right. In contrast, one of the greatest fears of any actor was this potential rejection from their audience. If his performance failed to be convincing or compelling, then this fear motivated them to work really hard at sort of preparing for the performance. And fear was a huge factor in what motivated them to work very hard. If an actor performed poorly and failed to portray his character persuasively or convincingly, he could be rejected by his audience. He could experience humiliation, embarrassment, ridicule, and shame. And in that culture, it was really people who appreciated the performance of an actor that kind of supported them. And if they didn't do a good job, then they were kind of out, materially and psychologically. The hypocrisy of the Pharisees was that they approached life similarly to the way in which an actor approached a script in a play, with detailed instructions from a lawyer and the support of their fellow Pharisees. They would study their lines and learn their parts. They would then perform a specific set of predetermined, mutually agreed upon religious acts before an audience of their peers. This is the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Herein lies the fundamental problem with hypocrisy. The external focus on the performance of their scripts provided them with the means of hiding from the truth regarding the problem of their hearts. Knowing their scripts as well as they did, performing them flawlessly, the outward appearance of their performance distracted them from the truth regarding the eternal condition of their hearts. They looked at their performance and concluded that they were doing it right. They were in effect persuaded by their own performance, and consequently they came to believe something about themselves that wasn't true. They thought because their performance was so well and so good, they thought that's what was true about themselves. And it distracted them from looking actually inside and understanding the eternal, as Kierkegaard puts it. This play acting became a contagious and institutionalized way of hiding. Consequently, instead of being a reflection of their desire to know and love and understand God, their religious zeal was instead a symptom of the rebelliousness of their hearts. Jesus continues in verse 2 and 3. There is nothing covered up that will not be revealed and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and whatever you have whispered in the whatever you have whispered in the inner rooms shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. Here Jesus explains that hiding from the reality of the corruption of my own heart through acting out a prescribed code of behavior doesn't work. According to Jesus, hypocrisy is a vain attempt to hide from the truth, and the truth will come to light. It's interesting to me that there's this phenomena going on in the crowd that Jesus sees. He sees them doing something. He sees them performing. In his words, they're hiding from the truth about themselves. He connects this with the Pharisees. And he sees it, and he talks about it with the disciples. So in a sense, he is exposing what these men have been trying to, in their attempt to hide from the truth about themselves. He was bringing what was previously in the dark out into the light. In verses 4 and 5, Jesus makes a connection between the actor who is motivated by the fear of failing to perform well and the Pharisees who approached to their relationship with God was motivated by the fear of men. He says, "And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that they have no more they can do. But I will tell you whom to fear. Fear the one who after he has killed has the authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." I'm glad you can get it. It's okay. Only in our culture. Like the actor who was motivated by the fear of his audience's approval or his disapproval or criticism, the Pharisees' fear of the displeasure of their audience preceded their desire to know and understand God. It was this fear of disapproval that motivated the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. And Jesus warns his disciples that being motivated out of this kind of fear was not the way to go, because men are limited in the harm that they can cause you, while God is not. Fear the one who can do you the most harm, is what Jesus is saying. Jesus is talking here about something that is all familiar, that we're all familiar with. We all are concerned on some level with how people think about us and what they feel about us. We want others' approval. It matters a whole lot to us. We hate to be rejected. We often have our antennas out, monitoring the situation and try to make the necessary adjustments so that we can adjust our behavior in order to achieve the desired response. We want approval. We don't want to get rejected. So we understand this. We understand this motivation that is underneath the Pharisees' hypocrisy. It's underneath their play acting. This inherent desire for approval as a meaning avoiding disapproval is what motivated the play acting of the Pharisees. It was the engine that gave their hypocrisy power. These men developed a script that was mutually acceptable to those who were part of the community. They worked hard at learning their lines. They paid close attention to detail and took their cues from those who seemed to be doing it right. Their play acting provided them with the means of approval from others, but most importantly, it was a means of distracting themselves from any discomfort they might experience as a result of looking the truth regarding the inner condition of their heart. Consequently, they missed knowing the mercy of God for themselves personally. So what can we learn from Luke's account of Jesus' warning to his disciples? First, Luke records that Jesus observed this behavior in the crowd, of people pressing against each other, stepping on one another, in order to apparently get close to him. Luke also records that Jesus comments about the crowd's behavior. Those comments reflect Jesus' understanding of what's going on. And Jesus likens the crowd's behavior to the hypocrisy that characterized the lives of the Pharisees. Jesus makes this direct association between the crowd's behavior and what was motivating their behavior and the Pharisees. Secondly, without the luxury of Luke's recording what Jesus has to say here about the crowd, I think as readers, you and I would probably have a very different perspective and understanding of what's really going on here, what was motivating their behavior. We might simply, we'd have this significant piece missing. I think without really understanding hearing what Jesus had to say about it, we might just think, well, these people just wanted to get as close to Jesus as they possibly could because, well, that's what we'd want to do. And we'd really miss what's going on. Yet as Jesus points out in his comments, this behavior on the part of the crowd was motivated by the fear of men. Jesus caught this moment in time like in a photograph, and he held it out for his disciples to see and understand. And through the pen and eye, through Luke's recording of this, you and I have the opportunity to understand this again through the eyes of Jesus. Thirdly, when the crowd acted as they did, they pressed against each other and they stepped on one another. They spoke volumes about themselves. And although they appeared to be interested in what Jesus was saying, in truth, they were most interested looking like they were interested. They were performing a role. And they were being motivated by fear rather than a real desire to know and understand God. This dynamic was also true of the Pharisees. They were actors acting out a script. And this is not how they would describe themselves. They perceived themselves as righteous, godly men who took their relationship with God seriously. They were very offended when Jesus called them hypocrites. This is not how they saw themselves. The Pharisees were mistaken about themselves. They were self-deceived. They looked at their performances, at their disciplined behavior, and they concluded that they were doing it right. They led that their performances, their play acting, led them to so identify themselves with their role of acting righteous, they came to believe that they were righteous because they acted righteous. They had lost sight of the fact that their play acting was just that. It was just acting. Let's look for a moment at Luke 18, because I think there's a parable here that illustrates this self-deception, starting with verse 9. And he told this parable to certain ones who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax gatherer. The Pharisee stood and was thus praying to himself. He's not praying to God here, he's praying to himself. He's praying to himself, God, I thank thee that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax gatherer. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. So the Pharisee is praying to himself and he says, God, I thank thee that I'm not like other people. And he does this immediately after he says this. He asserts the success of his performance, what a great job he did. He does this, he does this, he does this. He prays, he tithes. He fasts. That's his script. So he looks at his script, he sees how successful he's performed his script, and he declares himself, God, I thank thee that I'm not like other people. Even though he doesn't realize it, even though he's wrong and he's self-deceived, the Pharisee is mistaken. He is exactly like other people. He's so identified with his role, with his script, that he was doing what he thought a righteous man to do, that actually made him a righteous man. In truth, his religious, his role, his play acting was a symptom of his unwillingness to see the truth about himself, rather than his reflection of his love for God or his understanding of God. Fourthly, the major problem with hypocrisy is that it is antithetical to faith. The Pharisees believed that because they acted or like righteous men, that they were righteous men. In other words, righteousness was simply a matter of putting effort into acting according to a predetermined code of behavior. The actor who's, like in a, when he's in a play, who's counting on his ability and his efforts to do a good job and performing well, the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, the play acting the Pharisees, they're counting on their acting ability and performing this role to find favor with God. There's no faith in it. It's all based on their efforts to perform well. Trusting God to save us from our sin involves the struggle of pursuing righteousness. I think it involves first of God working in our hearts and giving us eyes to see what's valuable and what's true and giving us the desire to want righteousness. But our efforts towards that end offer no guarantee for success. Our sin is a much bigger and deeper problem than that. It is the process of coming to value righteousness through having God again open our eyes, giving us a heart that desires it. But it's coming to value righteousness through failure, an honest struggle to do the right thing, and failing terribly that matures our faith. It's not just putting effort into trying to do the right thing and being fooled by our efforts. Finally, the Pharisees were rebelliously blind to the sinful motivations of their heart. They were like the woman visiting heaven in Lewis's allegory, who was unwilling to concede that she could possibly be wrong. Both the woman and the Pharisees decidedly focused on the appearance of their outward behavior and consequently distracted themselves from facing into the brokenness of their internal state. For both of them, their eternal destiny hangs in the balance. In conclusion, we must take Jesus' warning to the Pharisees to heart and not be seduced by our own acting and believing that we're something that we're not. We must not assume that our seemingly upright and decent behavior is an accurate reflection of the motivations of our heart. We must concur with the bright spirit in talking to the woman when he says, "That's what we all find out when we reach this country. We've all been wrong. That's the great joke. There is no need to go on pretending one was right. And after that, we begin living." According to Lewis, heaven is a place where the residents have come to terms and accept the reality of their moral brokenness. Questions?
I was talking to someone this week who has enjoyed taking leaven out of their house, like the Jews did and do. Is leaven a starting point then? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees? I'm thinking not the word acting, but leaven,
I don't know that he's talking about it as a starting point so much as he's talking about it as a force. It's leaven, for those of you who don't know, I don't know if you used to be able to buy yeast in the store, but it used to be that, like, when a woman got married, actually, somebody would give them a jar of fermented dough. And then you would take that lump of dough, and you would mix it in with a new batch, and you'd mix it all in, and then it would have the ability to affect the whole new lump of dough and causing it to rise. Then you take another piece out of that, stick it back in the jar for the next time. So this little piece of fermented dough had the amazing ability to affect the whole piece of dough. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at here, is that hypocrisy has that kind of power. It's contagious, but it's also insidious, and it's kind of, you don't see it sometimes, or what's going on inside of it, but it has this effect. I think that's what he's getting at when he talks about leaven. I don't think he's talking about the starting point of it. I think he's talking about a sort of a quality of it or characteristic of it.
I don't quite understand the hypocrisy of the multitude stepping on each other.
Right.
Were they motivated by making everybody else think that they were more religious or more spiritual than other people by trying to push their way to the front of the crowd? Can you help me understand what was going on in their minds?
I don't know exactly what was going on in their minds, because I don't know that Jesus actually makes he explains exactly what was going on in his minds. But he's just got finished talking to the, confronting the Pharisees with their hypocrisy, and there's some really sort of out there glaring examples of it in chapter 11. I think what's going on here is that he sees something being played out in the crowd. He doesn't comment on what's going on in their minds, but what he sees in the crowd, then he makes this connection. He turns to his disciples and says, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." So he sees something going on in the crowd that's, and he correlates it to the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. So there was something about what they were doing or the psychology that was working in the crowd at the time that he saw and connected it to the hypocrisy of the Pharisees that he was really important to him, that he wanted to warn his disciples about. What we know about hypocrisy is that it is play acting, that it's not real. And we also know from what Jesus is saying here is that what's motivating it is this fear of men thing. If you were to ask a Pharisee why he did what he did, he would tell you, "Well, I'm doing it because I love God and because that's what I think God wants me to do." He wouldn't say, "I'm doing it because I'm afraid of men, or I'm afraid of men's disapproval." That's what Jesus understands and informs his disciples of, which is really helpful. It's really insightful. I mean, it's obviously Jesus is very insightful, but it helps us understand what's going on here. So I don't know that, again, I don't think Jesus makes a comment about the specific details of what these people are thinking, but he sees something happening, a dynamic, a psychology, and he observes that, and he makes this correlation. Does that help?
I've often wondered the significance of leaven or yeast, what Jesus was doing there. And contagion, the fact that it's contagious, seems to me one aspect of yeast
right.
He's referring to. But right now I'm inclined to think the dominant characteristic of yeast that he's referring to is the fact that it puffs up. If you take a small amount of dough, if you've ever made dough by hand, or bread by hand, you start out with, say, a pound of dough, and you mix your yeast in, and you let it rise until it's doubled, and it still weighs a pound, but it's twice as big.
Mm-hmm.
So yeast gives the ability of making something that is only so big actually look a lot bigger. And I started thinking about this when Paul in 1 Corinthians says, "Knowledge, as the King James Version says, puffeth up," which I think sounds really funny. And but love builds up. He's making this contrast between taking a pound of dough and making it look like 2 pounds of dough, as opposed to taking a pound of dough and adding to it so it actually is 2 pounds of dough.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like a good image to represent hypocrisy, to look like more than you really are.
I think that's, I don't know what exactly in Jesus' mind. I think that makes a lot of sense, because you look at the Pharisees, and even in this parable, in the parable in Luke 18, there's two things. One, the parable in Luke 18, the guy's praying to himself. I mean, he's sort of full of himself. And then you see in other passages in the New Testament, in the Gospels, these Pharisees love to sort of parade around and wear all these fancy clothes and draw attention to themselves. And so, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. So this idea of puffing up, I think, is accurate. But I also think there's the contagious aspect to it, and the insidiousness of it, and the power of it as well. So, thanks.
What's actually kind of funny is that when the Jews try to get the leaven out of their house,
mm-hmm.
it's everywhere. I mean,
oh, yeah.
One of the things that we did in a biochemistry lab was we caught our own yeast strains and made sourdough bread out of it. All you have to do is take some milk and throw a little sugar and maybe a little flour in there. Let it sit around for a couple of days. It starts bubbling. You've caught a yeast. It's everywhere.
Wow.
I was thinking of maybe one possibility of what the crowd may have been responding to.
Huh.
You talked about kind of the parading of the Pharisees and so forth. And you've got to think that the regular Joe and Jane are seeing that as well. but they're probably powerless to kind of confront the hypocrisy that's there, kind of this parading, and it's kind of a power thing, you know, where the Pharisees are powerful and the regular Joe and Jane aren't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus confronts that. I mean, he takes a lot of courage to kind of in front of God and everybody say, hey, these guys are don't have the right answer. And I think, I know in my own life, it's like I want answers for my life so that I can make it mm-hmm. manageable and so that I can control it.
Sure.
So that I don't have to hurt and I don't have to be afraid and all those kinds of things. And so Jesus comes and I think the crowd interprets that as, hey, this guy has the answers. And so they're doing the very same thing that the Pharisees are doing. They're saying, oh, mm-hmm. well, what we need is the right answer. Mm-hmm. We need to learn to do it right. And it looks like Jesus is doing it right, so we're going to do it this way.
Yeah, there's a lot of psychological comfort in believing or thinking that you have the answers or that you're doing it right. And certainly that's part of a huge part, I think, of what was going on with the Pharisees. And they seem to have this insatiable desire to be right. And I mean, I think we can all relate to this. We can all relate to this fear of disapproval, this wanting approval, wanting people to like us. We all know what that's about. And we all can relate to this. It's very uncomfortable. I mean, I think being a Christian is a very difficult thing to do. It's actually easier to, and from my perspective, at least looking back, it was easier to be a non-Christian because here I have this, I'm beginning to have some perspective, I think, of what's good and what's not good in life and how things work, and this desire to do what's right, and yet I find myself failing miserably. That's a very psychologically a very uncomfortable place to live. Well, if I can go from that to that experience, of that daily experience, of that kind of frustration, and go to a place where I can have some kind of guarantee, some kind of security that I'm doing it right, which would I rather have? It's very appealing to go to this, I mean, to get rules. It's like what we were talking about a couple weeks ago about this approach people take to the scriptures. If they're looking for answers and they find the answers and they do it, then they're okay. It's that, it has, that's has a lot of appeal to people. And it's an easy trap to fall into. And we can look at how we all respond when somebody tells us we're doing something wrong. We can get really defensive pretty quick. And these guys, Jesus is telling these guys over and over and over again in lots of different ways that they're wrong. And that is just flying into the face of their whole system, their whole deal. They wanted to be right. And so I think that's a lot of why they were so hostile towards Jesus. One thing I want to communicate here is that I think with human beings, there's this tendency to listen to stuff like this or listen to and say, okay, yeah, it's out there. But I hope I've communicated in such a way that I think we need to look at the similarities and the crossovers that we have with what's true about the Pharisees.
I have a two-part question.
Okay.
One is, I'm always wondering whether Jesus, you know, after he was tempted three times in the desert,
right?
I always wondered if he kept continually being tempted. And this is an occasion where the adulation of a crowd might be tempting to Jesus to somehow fall into the trap that the Pharisees fell into. Or perhaps maybe he's trying to warn his disciples that this crowd-pleasing thing is a strong temptation and try to warn them against that. That's the first part of my question. Do you see that happening?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. I always wondered, when I looked at this passage, I've always wondered where the Pharisees were in the crowd. Because Jesus doesn't really say. I suspect that they're trying to get up front, but I don't know that. But that certainly is a question that I have about the crowd. Certainly he's responding to some dynamic in the crowd. And that's possible. I don't know.
That's a good question. The second part of my question was, in this symbiotic relationship between the play actor and the crowd, doesn't the crowd take some kind of responsibility in that relationship?
Wow, that's a good question. I think, well, I don't know exactly what response. I mean, sure, we have a responsibility to be wise, I suppose, and see reality for what it is, and we're responsible for when we don't see reality for what it is, and we're seduced by unreality. I think we're. What strikes me, though, is, well, I think that's true, is there is a, I mean, one of the points here, I think, that is evident here, is that Jesus took this opportunity to point this dynamic and this psychology out to his disciples, because I don't know if in this particular case, it's not as clear as it was in the cases that he cites in Luke 11. I think it's more subtle here, and maybe there's this dynamic in the group that's, you know, there's all this, you can kind of get caught up in it. Maybe that's part of what he's talking about too. But it's striking to me that Jesus chooses this moment as opposed to, I mean, the disciples are there in Luke 11 and they're seeing, they're watching this. But he takes this moment to look at what's going on in the crowd, and he turns to them and he says, this is important. See this. Understand this. So he's saying, look, and he's sort of exposing it. And I think it's actually more subtle here than it is in Luke 11, so maybe that's part of it. Logan.
The actor is role-playing.
Right.
You know, he's really immersing himself in this image, this reality that he's created.
Yeah.
even if you took away the role-playing that some of the Pharisees did, they're still held accountable for making their prayers and giving their alms and doing this, you know, going through the ritual. God still held them, you know, as Jews, responsible for obeying, you know, going through the motions. Isn't the difference when the role player is trying to convince his audience that he really is this person, or convince himself that he really is this role that he's acting out?
I think that's very insightful, Logan. I think it's not just the audience that he's trying to convince, it's himself. And I actually think that's more the case, that he's really trying to convince himself.
And isn't a lot of our attempts at self, what's the word they use, where you're always, you know, the makeover, the creating a new you, isn't there a myth within the church that you can step into this role, and if you just step into it and believe it and commit to it, you will become it?
Yeah, I think it's called a victorious Christian life.
And isn't Jesus...
I think that's the myth.
Yeah, and isn't Jesus... don't you have in this group of Pharisees the, you know, the bullshitter who knows he's bullshitting, and the guy who's hoodwinked himself into believing he's really in there?
Isn't it amazing how old this is? How familiar this is? We can look at our culture today and it's the same thing. Isn't it striking? We're doing the same thing today that Jesus was calling them on back then. The human condition is a consistent problem. Then Deanna, and then we'll stop.
One of the first things, the first teachings I ever heard as a Christian was about the difference between sort of God's undying love and performance love. And having come from a family that was fairly dysfunctional, I've sat in the back of the room just completely broken, realizing that my whole life was a performance for that type of approval.
Right.
And so I've always kind of related it as it's part of our sin nature to withdraw our love when we're not happy with the other person's performance. So I guess a little bit of mercy for the crowd would be that they're sort of set up to behave in this way to gain this approval. And that was one of the things that attracted me to God and that I liked about God was that I didn't have to perform. Not that I didn't fall into the pattern, but that I understood I didn't have to.
Yeah, I think we learn some bad stuff through life experiences and We have a lot of beliefs that are in conflict with the actual gospel and God's perspective on us that are important to work through and keep working with ourselves. Because even if we have a realization, oh yeah, God's love is different than my parents' love or whatever, we still have this propensity towards wanting to be in control and wanting to earn it and all this stuff. We take that with us, plus all these false beliefs, and then fortunately God's committed to us into working it out and helping us see what's true, as painful as it is. One more, Deanna.
So is the warning, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, is it more, do you think he's saying, I'm warning you disciples to look at something and learn, or is it more pointing the finger at the Pharisees, or is it a little bit of both? You know, where's the warning in the word beware? I don't know.
Well, I think he's warning them about hypocrisy, but he's also warning them of the power of it, of the influence of it, the insidiousness of it. So I think he's doing a little bit of both.
So he's definitely saying that the disciples are capable of this as well, to a certain degree?
I would think he would say, I think if you're going to ask him that question, I think he'd say we're all capable of it.
Right. So even people with the best of knowledge can
absolutely
be hypocrites.
Sure. Yeah.
I misinformed you several weeks back. I just want to make this clear. I thought I would be starting teaching in 1 John again next week, so you don't need to bring your translations. There's two more weeks. Wes is going to teach out of Ecclesiastes for 2 weeks, and then I will return the week after that in 1 John. So. Thank you, Larry.
Sure.